your talking newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill, and this is the Red Saturn programme for Saturday, September the 19th, 2020. I do hope you're all well and staying safe. As I'm sure you know, these programmes are being posted out to our listeners on a USB memory stick for use in the boombox player, as in the past. We have one small problem, however, for which we'd very much appreciate your help. It appears that we're not always receiving the USBs and their poster wallets back at HQ, so if you have one of these lying around waiting to be posted back to us, it would be fantastic if you could just arrange for it to be dropped in a postbox, as our supplies are beginning to run low. As well as the USB sticks, you can of course find us online at sadtn.org.uk. And a selection of our news stories and the radio listings are broadcast on Radio Verulam on Sunday from 8 to 9am and 6 to 7pm. This week, following the news stories and radio listings, we have Rupert Evershed's Nature Notes and a couple of articles from Hearts Life magazine, one about the de Havilland Aircraft Company and the other about Samuel Stone, who was born in Hartford in 1602 and founded Hartford, the capital of Connecticut, in 1637. After that, we have an interview with Rod King, MBE, founder of the national campaign group 20's Plenty, which works to extend 20-mile-per-hour speed limits more widely in our towns and cities. The music this week is by a gypsy jazz ensemble called Shilanigig, who hail from Bristol. The track I've chosen is Tansu, which they have kindly given permission for us to use. As usual, I'll play it in full at the end of the programme. We start with the news, and our readers this week are Jenny, Dominic, Anna and Caroline.
Hello, I'm Jenny. My first story this week is entitled £500,000 Raised to Save Alvia. A £500,000 fundraising campaign to help save the life of a red-born student suffering from leukemia has smashed its target in days. Alvia Cohen has what he describes as the bad kind of leukemia, as he is in the 10% of patients who cannot be cured. Intense chemotherapy, a bone marrow transplant from his twin brother Justin, and other treatments have failed to kill the cancer, and time is running out. His one hope lies in receiving pioneering treatment in Singapore at a cost of £500,000. But a community fundraising GoFundMe campaign set up to try to raise the cost of the treatment managed to hit a target within a week, with almost 18,000 people donating. Alvia said, "I've been overwhelmed by the support I've received. Thank you so much." Alvia, who is shortly due to take up a place at St John's College, Oxford University, explained, "I've been told I've just a few months to live. I was also told a year ago my leukemia was incurable. One of the great new breakthroughs in cancer care in recent years has been CAR-T treatment, where they modify the T cells, one type of defence cell, to attack the disease. But I have T cell leukemia, and they've not been able to safely get T cells to attack diseased T cells. Until now." That was until a few weeks ago. A specialist team in Singapore has a brand new treatment which claims to have cured a 5-year-old boy in the UK in a similar condition. "I now have a chance to go and get the same treatment, a chance to have a normal life as a teenager, cancer-free, a chance to really start my journey. I feel like cancer has robbed me of the last 3 years. I won't let it take any more." Alvia has to finance the cost himself, but added, "I can't tell you how amazing it is that ordinary people want to reach out and help someone in need." And there's a picture of Alvin with his cat. It's lovely. See www.gofundme.com/f/alvias-chance-for-r-future.
Hello, my name's Caroline, and my first story today is about one of the most important members of the St Albans community who we have sadly lost very recently. A remarkable woman. Remembering a pillar of district community. A civic funeral has taken place to commemorate the life of Honorary Alderman Kathleen Moody and in recognition of her service to the city and district of St Albans. Kathleen was a hard-working and committed local councillor and chair of the planning committee, where meetings regularly went on into the early hours. She served for many years, latterly as district councillor for Marshalswick North, standing down in 1987. She was also deputy mayor from 1977 to 1978. Kathleen was born in 1927 in Woolstanton in the Potteries. An only child, she was clearly extremely bright. She was able to read before she started school, so found having to learn all over again with her peers deeply frustrating. She never forgot the extreme poverty she observed as a child, and the memory stayed with her all through her life. At the age of 11, she won a scholarship to Orme Girls' School in Newcastle-under-Lyme, and in 1946 a scholarship to Newnham College, Cambridge, to read physics. While at Cambridge, she worked at the Cavendish Laboratories and was there at the same time as Francis Crick, who received a Nobel Prize for his work on the structure of DNA. At the request of Newnham College, Kathleen wrote an account of her time at Cambridge, the difficulties of coping with shortages just after the war, her mother adapting her school uniform, dyeing white blouses which turned out unfortunate colours, the lack of heating in the winter of 1946-1947, and the adequate but not entirely appetising food, such as suet roll stuffed with spinach and a meaty whale stew. It would appear that during this time of basic shortages, the men's colleges were favoured over the women's, as they were academically. Kathleen did well. She was awarded a blue for netball, although, being a woman, she wasn't allowed to wear her blue blazer in the centre of Cambridge, and she was one of the first women to actually be awarded her degree by the university. It was at university that Kathleen met her husband Brian. They were happily married for almost 65 years until his death in 2016. At his wake, Kathleen, at the age of 88, gave a moving and wonderful tribute to her husband, speaking for 25 minutes without notes. It was during this address that we learned that Brian, who worked in the glass industry, was instrumental in standardising the size of wine bottles across the EU at 75 centilitres. He was no longer involved when the size of spirit bottles was mandated at 70 centilitres. After university and marriage, Brian and Kathleen moved to Blackheath, and Kathleen lectured in physics locally. In 1967, they moved to St Albans, where Brian had his origins. Kathleen and Brian carried out regular testing for the Consumer Association, and Kathleen chaired the Eastern Electricity Consumer Council from 1979 to 1987. Forthright, steadfast, sometimes fierce, but also loyal, kind, generous, fun-loving, and deeply caring about others, everyone who knew Kathleen grew to love and respect her. She struggled bravely to maintain as much as she could of an independent life as her condition worsened, and she became increasingly infirm, although her wonderful mind remained sharp and she took a keen interest in what was happening in all aspects of life, from politics to sport. Friends and family admired her indomitable spirit and her courage in facing her final illness. To all those who knew her, Kathleen was a remarkable person.
Hello, my name is Dominic, and the first story has the headline, Bevan overcomes broken bikes to complete charity cycle ride across the UK. A charity fundraiser has vowed to pay the salary of one of Rennie Grove Hospice's nursing team for a whole year. Bevan Clark wanted to do something to help after seeing COVID decimating the income of the hospice, which supports and cares for people with life-limiting illnesses. Rennie Grove, which depends mainly on the public's generosity to meet its budget, saw all of its charity shops closed for months and numerous fundraising events had to be cancelled, including a challenge to cycle to the Isle of Man and ride the notorious TT race circuit. But the pandemic didn't deter Bevan, who embarked on a solo cycle from Land's End to John O'Groats to raise much-needed funds. Riding over 100 miles every day and sleeping each night in a motorhome, Bevan overcame numerous problems, including extreme weather, hostile bees, and several mechanical issues, including a total gear failure that required a bike swap. Despite only taking up cycling in May and riding an old hybrid bike for the last 200 miles of his route, Bevan completed his epic journey in just 9 days, raising much-needed funding for Rennie Grove in memory of his best friend, Steve Russell, who passed away exactly a year ago. Bevan's reward for months of training, during which he lost 2 stones and a fortnight on the road away from his home and family, is that Bev's big charity bike ride stands close to having raised £25,000. He said, "I knew the first day was going to be tough, being the first anniversary of Steve's passing, but it was far more difficult than I had predicted. On top of all the emotion, I hadn't foreseen some substantial problems on the first day, forgetting my cycling shoes and problems with my gears on my bike. It was not an ideal start. I underestimated how important my support crew following me in a campervan were to become. From sourcing campsites to providing breakfast, lunch and dinner, and above all being my cheerleaders, I could not have achieved it without them." Back at home, the funds and messages of support came flooding in. Every new donation sent an update to my phone, and these updates kept me pedaling to the very end. My supporters seemed to enjoy seeing my Facebook posts, particularly my live videos, and I seem to have created my own catchphrase, "Rennie Grove, baby." Despite 2 broken bikes, I completed the challenge a day quicker than planned and managed to exceed the fundraising target of £25,000. Bevan is now eager to reach £30,000 before the fundraiser closes in order to pay the salary of one of Rennie Grove's nursing team for a whole year. Donations can still be made at bevsbigcharityride.com. On the second day of his ride, Bevan was kept company by several members of Team Forge, whose latest challenge is a sequel to their 2015 Isle of Wight event in support of Rennie Grove. Team member David Fryer explained, "In 2015, a group of people calling themselves Team Forge cycled from St Albans to the Isle of Wight, around it and back via Swindon. Were it not for COVID, we would have returned to the Isle of Man to celebrate the 5th anniversary of that first island challenge and to raise more much-needed funds for Rennie Grove. As luck would have it, COVID meant the plans have been put back a year to September 2021. We hope to have 40 people cycling to the Isle of Man around the TT circuit this time next year and to raise £100,000 for Rennie Grove." Businesses interested in sponsoring Team Forge when they set off to the Isle of Man next year can find out more about the event by contacting info@teamforge.org.uk. That's info@teamforge.org.uk. Team Forge is an informal group of local people who join together, usually on bikes, to raise funds for Rennie Grove, and you'll be able to follow their progress and see some of their stories in the Hearts ad over the coming year. Accompanying the story is a picture of Bevan Clark standing under the John O'Groat signpost after completing the ride. There's also a couple of other pictures in the article, with a picture of Bevan looking very rain-swept in Scotland while constructing a rideable bike out of 2 broken bikes. And then there's a picture of Bevan with David Fryer wearing the Isle of Wight 2015 jersey. He's one of the Team Forge members who rode on stage 2 of Bevan's ride.
Hello, I'm Anna, and my first story this week is called "Champing at the Bit. St Albans MP is new Lib Dem deputy leader." Days after her appointment as the Liberal Democrats' new deputy leader, St Albans MP Daisy Cooper is already looking at future victories. She wants to use her position to replicate the party's historic win in St Albans constituency at the last general election, which overturned an 11% Tory lead and saw her win by 6,000 votes. Back in December, Liberal Democrats won St Albans for the first time in our history, but it didn't happen overnight. It took us 3.5 years to win the seat by getting out there and talking about our values about being an open internationalist party which believes in environmentalism and civil liberties, as well as working alongside the community to improve people's lives and livelihoods. Using my experience of winning St Albans, we can start to become a lightning rod for those who share our values, to build a campaigning machine and to stop Johnson's Tories. Daisy believes her path to victory can be replicated to threaten sitting Tory MPs in up to 82 constituencies where her party is running second. We'll be setting out to win over voters who share our values, and that will include the many soft Conservative voters who found the current government at odds with their values of competent government, respect for the law, international alliances, civil liberties, and protection of the environment, and who we know are repulsed by the thuggish values of the Tories under Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings. Sir Ed Davey has also appointed Daisy as Lib Dem spokesman on education. The idea that education is a route to opportunity remains a core part of liberal democratic values today. It's shocking that in the 21st century we have children going to school with hungry tummies, so I'll be putting child poverty and free school meals at the front of the agenda. I'll also be pushing for better support for children with special educational needs who've been the victims of the horrendous slashing of school budgets under the Tory government. Daisy said her constituency work will benefit from her higher profile in Parliament and on the national stage. I've helped thousands of constituents and talked with hundreds of local organisations since being elected, but there's a lot more to be done, especially as we all work together to adjust to life with and after COVID-19. I intend to use the bigger national platform I've been granted to campaign in Parliament on the issues facing St Albans residents and to continue striving to be the dedicated constituency MP that St Albans deserves.
More than 60,000 job cuts possible as recession grip tightens. More than 60,000 jobs could be lost across Hertfordshire in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, leaving the county with an unemployment problem for the first time in a generation. Before the start of the pandemic, jobs in Hearts were relatively easy to find and unemployment levels ran at around 2%. But by May, it had been reported unemployment levels had increased to 5%, and now members of Hearts County Council's Growth Infrastructure Planning and Economy Cabinet panel have heard job losses in the county could top 60,000 by the end of the year. Speaking at a meeting of the Cabinet panel, Neil Hayes, Chief Executive of the Hertfordshire Local Enterprise Partnership, said more will be known after furlough ends in October. He told councillors that as of July, 160,000 employees in Hearts were furloughed, 28% of the overall workforce, and 52,600 claims had been made under the Self-Employment Income Support Scheme, a take-up rate of 76%. He told councillors this recession is expected to be significant in terms of jobs in the county, and there is likely to be a jobs problem. Mr Hayes also said economic fundamentals of Hertfordshire, such as its skilled workforce, connectivity and employment in growth sectors, are still in place. So our ability to bounce back should be more pronounced than other parts of the UK, he said. Continuing, however, we still need to understand what short-term action is needed to help businesses bounce back. Some of these things are going to lead to long-term structural changes. There are clearly big challenges for our high streets and town centres. I also think there are big opportunities for towns in Hearts to repurpose some of those town centres for employment use, for digital remote working, for example. In making the point, he highlighted anecdotal evidence that businesses in London are looking for space outside the capital.
Rosh Hashanah. St Albans Cathedral is helping the local Jewish community to practice a significant tradition which may have otherwise been hampered by COVID. Jews hear the shofar, a horn of a ram, blown on Rosh Hashanah on September 18th to 20th to symbolise wakening them for repentance before the Jewish New Year of Rosh Hashanah. St. Albans Cathedral has come to their aid by agreeing that the rabbi can climb the bell tower on September the 19th at 8 p.m. and blow the animal horn from the top of the abbey, while community members can gather on the grass below and hear the sound. Rabbi Adam Zagoria Moffat of St. Albans Masorti Synagogue said, "I'm so excited about this, and I think it's an amazing example of how faith communities work together to support each other, especially in these strange times."
This next story is in celebration of two of the oldest residents in St. Albans. Two centuries celebrated by city care home residents. Two St. Albans care home residents have celebrated their centenary. Margaret Almond, who has lived in Verulam House in Verulam Road since January 2016, received a surprise social distanced visit from her family to mark the occasion of her 100th birthday. She was born in Rotherham, South Yorkshire, and had two sisters, Vinnie and Mabel, who are sadly no longer with us. Growing up, Margaret was very involved with the church, as her father was a verger. She worked for many years as a school secretary, which she loved, before having her two children, John and Jane, with her husband, Noel. Margaret also has a granddaughter, Katie, and her interests included gardening, knitting, playing badminton, watching cricket and snooker, and socialising with her friends. Meanwhile, Grace Muriel House resident Enid Robinson received a couple of special surprises when celebrating her 100th. Despite the restrictions on visitors due to lockdown and the extra protection measures, over 20 people gathered at the end of the house's driveway on Tavistock Avenue to serenade Enid with renditions of "Happy Birthday" and "For She's a Jolly Good Fellow." "I knew nothing about it," said Enid, who has been a resident since March 2018. "I was blindfolded when they took me out and was asking, 'Where are you taking me? Am I outside?' When the blindfold was removed, it was a lovely surprise to see most of my family and friends, especially my youngest great-grandchild, who is 6 months old and who I haven't seen before. I'm lucky to have lots of friends, including my long-term friend Jenny, who I met at the United Reformed Church many years ago and who organised the party." Following the singing, the local postman arrived to present Enid with a birthday card from the Queen. "I said thank you to Her Majesty and curtsied from my chair as best I could," she said. She took a look at the Queen's picture on the cover and exclaimed, "I look better than her," provoking a roar of laughter from the audience. Enid has managed to be in touch regularly with her son, daughter and grandchildren since lockdown began. She said, "In normal circumstances, they will be popping in and out and taking me out, but visits now are more frequently over WhatsApp and FaceTime. I speak to one of them every night and enjoy garden visits when permitted." Enid has led a very active life. She met her late husband Robbie during the war, following which they moved to St. Albans. An accomplished badminton player, she managed to play regularly up until the age of 90, and attended a weekly canasta group until lockdown prevented them from meeting. Staff at Grace Muriel House love Enid's outgoing and sociable nature. Registered manager Annette Gibbons said, "Enid has a young outlook and takes pride in her appearance. She has a good rapport with the staff and had developed a close friendship within the home, which has helped her to cope during lockdown. She has had a number of physical setbacks, but she is a strong and determined lady who will always do her best to bounce back." Celebrations continued throughout the day. In the afternoon, we had a lovely party with some of the friends I've made at Grace Muriel House, and Laurelie, one of the cooks, made a beautiful cake covered in flowers. "I had a fantastic day," she added. When asked about her favourite experiences of the last 100 years, Enid added, "I have had a good life and overcome some difficult times, but I have made so many good and lasting friendships, and I have a wonderful, loving family." And this article is accompanied with some really fantastic pictures. There's a picture of Enid cutting her cake, which is bright green and is covered with the most beautiful orange and yellow sugar paste roses, and it has a blue swirly decoration on the top saying "Happy Birthday." And there's another picture of Enid opening her card from the Queen. Lovely picture on the Queen with some balloons all around her. A really wonderful article.
Should bubbles be smaller in our largest secondary schools? Officials ponder. Education officials in Hertfordshire are reflecting on the size of COVID bubbles in large secondary schools in the wake of recent outbreaks of the coronavirus. Pupils are grouped into bubbles within all schools as part of a package of measures to reduce any spread of the virus within schools. They remain within these bubbles, typically a single class in primary schools and a year group in secondary schools, throughout the day. Should there be an outbreak of COVID-19 within a bubble, pupils may be asked to self-isolate for 2 weeks. But with some Hertfordshire secondary schools having a year group of up to 270 pupils, education officials are starting to question whether that is too big. At a meeting of the County Council's Education, Libraries and Localism Cabinet Panel on Tuesday, September the 7th, Head of School Standards and Accountability, Tanya Rule, said the issue was being considered. Tanya Rule said, "Schools are best placed to determine what the size of the bubble should be. However, one of the things we are learning over the last few weeks, and schools will be also learning this, is that some of the bubbles in some of the secondary schools are quite large. So if you get a positive case in one of those bubbles, you may have a lot of children being sent home to self-isolate for 2 weeks. And that may repeat itself a number of times throughout the year, which obviously will impact on children's education." She said the issue had now been highlighted and they would be thinking about it and talking to schools. Tanya Rawl continued, "That's something we will start to reflect on and work with schools to see how we can support them to manage this perhaps in a different way." Earlier in the meeting, Operations Director Simon Newland stressed that the organisation of bubbles reflected the individual circumstances of each school.
Next is Rainbow Day. The St Albans Nursery has held a special Rainbow Day to show thanks to key workers and the NHS. Nursery manager Hannah Oxley organised the event at Monkey Puzzle Day Nursery to encourage positive conversations regarding people who help us and what the NHS is. The children enjoyed a rainbow menu, which included colourful vegetable rice and blueberries, peach and strawberries for morning fruit snack, and both staff and children all dressed up in rainbow-themed outfits. They also made rainbow artwork, used doctors' and nurses' role-play outfits, and took part in different colour-related activities. Owner Amanda Griffiths said, "As the owner, I'm so proud of all my staff. We've made no redundancies over lockdown and have welcomed back our community. The nursery is an extremely happy place at a tricky time." Staff have said that they have loved Rainbow Day as it allowed such positive learning. And there's a lovely picture at the top of this piece with five of the key workers standing in multicoloured clothes and four of the children looking very happy, all standing in the sunshine indoors.
This next story touches on a difficult subject which affects our whole society. Stories shared on World Suicide Prevention Day. Hertfordshire's Suicide Prevention Network has been working with a range of people to share their lived experiences of suicide in a bid to raise awareness this World Suicide Prevention Day, September the 10th. Suicide prevention remains a universal challenge, which can often have a devastating effect on families, friends, colleagues, first responders, staff, the wider community, and beyond. It has been estimated to affect around 135 people. Helen, who lost her partner to suicide when she was pregnant, was thankful for the support that she got, but said more home-based care would have been helpful, as seeking help can often be too much to do. The Hearts mum explained that people's reactions were often not helpful by saying, "The way they asked questions about my partner's death or the way they just spoke about suicide in general was really hard to swallow." But she said this experience has allowed her to help others by hosting public talks and setting up a Facebook group called We Can Do This. "You can choose the path to help other people, and that's the way I've gone in my life," There are so many people who want to help you, and to lose someone to suicide is horrific. She added that people are not alone and that there is always someone out there to help you. Hertfordshire County Council's Cabinet Member for Public Health and Prevention, Councillor Tim Hutchings, said, "World Suicide Prevention Day provides the opportunity for us to raise awareness on the importance of suicide prevention. This year, our Suicide Prevention Network has worked with a range of inspirational people to share their experiences of suicide. By working together, we can raise awareness and reach our vision that no one in Hertfordshire should feel like suicide is their only option." Hearts Detective Inspector Joe Briggs said, "Our mental health and policing team are part of the Hertfordshire Suicide Prevention Network. We continue to work hard to give the best possible service to people in mental health crisis because no suicide is inevitable. These stories are extremely moving and we hope they give the confidence to people to reach out for help." Hertfordshire Partnership University NHS Foundation Trust HPFT Chief Executive Tom Cahill added, "Each and every death by suicide is devastating for the person and their loved ones. On World Suicide Prevention Day 2020 and every day, HPFT will continue working together with others so that we keep learning and understanding more about how we can help prevent these tragic and unnecessary deaths." During the day, Govia Thames Link Railway, GTR, which operates Thames Link and Great Northern, unveiled Affirmation Art Clusters across some of its busiest stations to raise awareness of the company's ongoing support and understanding to those who may be feeling vulnerable. In the last year, there have been 426 GTR interventions and 35 fatalities, with a 57% increase in life-saving interventions since 2019 across GTR's rail network. GTR Suicide Prevention Manager Laura Campbell said, "My grandmother sadly took her own life on the railway when my mum was just 4 years old. Back then, there wasn't the support around that there is now, and I don't think she's ever processed it properly. It's one of the key reasons why I took on this role. My main focus is on supporting as many people as possible with the work we're doing to prevent suicide. I think it's incredibly important that we're raising awareness and showing signs of positivity on what will be quite a stark day for many." Hearts residents experiencing a mental health crisis are also able to access a mental health professional directly by calling the NHS 111 service. Selecting option 2 for mental health services will automatically direct Hearts callers to the 24/7 HPFT helpline team. Hertfordshire Partnership NHS Foundation Trust has also launched a new free helpline, 0800 644 4101, for people in Hertfordshire who are experiencing a mental health crisis, looking for mental health help, or just need to talk. Support is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whatever you're going through, you can also call Samaritans for free at any time from any phone on 116 123. This number is free to call and will not appear on your phone bill.
The annual St Albans Chamber of Commerce Business Awards are back for the 11th year with an online ceremony. The awards recognise the outstanding achievements both individuals and businesses have made in the district. Now more than ever, it is important to pull together as a community and celebrate those who have made a positive impact and gone that extra mile. The virtual ceremony will be taking place on Thursday, September the 30th, and tickets include an awards programme, drink and snack. Chamber President Alistair Woodgate said, "The awards are a highlight of the business year. They celebrate those who are making a positive difference through their outstanding contributions to the life of our business community and the wider community. And in the current climate, it's great to have something so positive to shout about. What continually impresses me about the district's businesses is the degree to which companies and individuals wish to engage with the wider community. This is not just to fulfil corporate social responsibility goals, but it's because people want to play an active role in supporting the various initiatives and organisations that combine to make our district a special place. Alistair added, "Thank you to our sponsors, Pearl Drop Video Productions, The Hearts Advertiser, Rayner Essex, St Albans BID, Bradham's Fantastic Flowers, Stanta and Rumble Sedgwick, without whom the entire awards process would not be possible. And to all our finalists, I want to say, being a finalist means that each and every one of you is a worthy winner. That's why you've made the shortlist. Knowing that a business expert has taken a look at your product, service or contribution and sees the value in it and believes it worthy of an award is a real boost." There are various categories of awards up for grabs this year. The Young Employee, Sustainability, Best Restaurant, Customer Commitment, New Business, Business Growth and Business Leader. And the finalists will be listed on the Chamber's website.
St Albans Signal Box. St Albans' celebrated historical signal box has gone digital for the month. St Albans South Signal Box is opening digitally for this year's Heritage Open Days, which run until September the 20th. Unable to reopen at the moment due to the virus precautions, members of the Signal Box Trust have put together a series of videos that provide a virtual tour of the Signal Box, the display garden, museum area and, of course, the ever-popular garden railway, complete with Thomas the Tank Engine and some of his friends. Trust Chairman Tony Furze said, "We wanted to allow our potential visitors to be able to enjoy some of the features of the Signal Box and its garden while we remain closed." And the videos are on YouTube and can be accessed through the Trust website at www.sigbox.co.uk. And there's a lovely picture through the wildflowers of some of the signals amongst all the greenery in their little garden.
Cancer Charity's urgent appeal over fundraising crisis and rise in demand. A cancer charity facing a tsunami of demand at a time when fundraising from its flagship event is set to hit a devastating low is appealing for urgent help. Last year, people in Hertfordshire raised £405,300 for Macmillan Cancer Support by taking part in the charity's annual coffee morning. The money raised is used to fund vital services, including nurses and patient grants, but early figures show the number of people planning to hold a coffee morning this year, which officially falls on September 25th, has fallen by two-thirds due to the coronavirus pandemic. The £27.5 million raised in the UK in 2019 is expected to fall to under £8 million this year, the lowest raised in 11 years. The charity fears its supporters don't realise the event is still going ahead in a virtual or socially distanced format and is urging people to find out more. Hearts Macmillan fundraising manager Evie Wilson said, "There has never been a more terrifying time in recent history to receive a cancer diagnosis, with disruption and delays to treatment and fears of increased risk of becoming infected with coronavirus. A huge 98% of Macmillan's income is from donations and events like the coffee morning. While the coffee morning can't take place in exactly the same way as before this year, there are still lots of ways to get involved. At Macmillan, we're facing a possible tsunami of demand coming towards us this autumn, as the cancer system gets moving again and the backlog of delayed diagnoses begins to be dealt with. Worryingly, this increased need for support will come at a time when our fundraised income has dropped significantly. We're facing the hardest year in our 109-year history. It's no exaggeration to say Macmillan and people with cancer have never needed the public's help more than we do right now. Macmillan will advise people who sign up to the coffee morning on how to hold the event safely during the pandemic. To sign up to the coffee morning, take on the first ever coffee morning challenge with a run, walk or cycle, or raise a mug, take a selfie and make a donation. Visit coffee.macmillan.org.uk or call 0330 102 7810. And there's a lovely picture of an iced cake with a banner for Macmillan.
Health chief intervenes personally to get virus test for 90-year-old. Hertfordshire's public health chief has had to wade into the COVID-19 testing conundrum, personally intervening to ensure a 90-year-old could get a test closer to home. Hertfordshire's Director of Public Health, Jim McManus, highlighted the exceptional case at a meeting on Thursday, September the 10th, when he was questioned about testing capacity in the county. The elderly gentleman had been directed to a testing centre some way from his Hertfordshire home. But Mr McManus, who is the county's Director of Public Health, said he had personally intervened so he could avoid the long journey. The news comes as residents from other areas in North Hertfordshire suggest they too have struggled to obtain a test, with one Stevenage resident alleging that her nearest test centre was 90 miles away and another being told to travel to Aberdeen. Mr McManus said he had known there had been capacity at the centre and added, "We keep a very close eye on testing issues in Hertfordshire because it's important to us." At the meeting of the County Council's Public Health and Prevention Cabinet Panel, Liberal Democrat Councillor Nigel Quinton also raised the issue of COVID-19 testing for residents who did not have access to a car. He highlighted a resident who could see the Welwyn Garden City testing centre from her home, but was not allowed to be tested there because it is a drive-through facility. Mr McManus told councillors he would like there to be a non-drive-through facility in Welwyn Garden City, and he indicated that in some cases, transport could be arranged for testing. During the meeting, Mr McManus accepted there were issues with the testing capacity on the national system. Meanwhile, it was reported that contacts of those who test positive for COVID-19 who cannot be traced within 24 hours by the national test and trace system are now being dealt with locally. As a result, in addition to attempting to contact them by phone, there are now local door-knocking teams who carry leaflets in English and relevant languages. And Mr McManus said that they now had a 91% completion rate.
This next story is about another wonderful member of the St Albans community who's talking about the impact that the COVID lockdown has had on small businesses. Cosita's founder, Emma, on the challenges of post-lockdown trading. Expanding your business weeks after the coronavirus shutdown would be a risky venture for anyone. But for Emma Bustamante, it was a case of do or die. Mother of three, Emma, who founded home furnishings and gift shop Cosita's on Hollywell Hill in 2017, is keen to secure her business's long-term future by attracting new customers. The store was shut for 3 months during the pandemic, and although she used the opportunity to expand Cosita's online presence, she needs to recoup lost revenue. So she has launched a second shop in the Village Arcade to capture much-needed festive trade and signpost city centre customers to the original premises. Emma said, "It feels like a scary move at an uncertain time, but I'm so aware of the need to serve our customers as best we can. Having a presence right in town has hopefully enabled us to do this." The 45-year-old has always had a very hands-on approach to her business. "Being on the shop floor is the best market research ever because we get it straight from the horse's mouth. With the changing retail climate before COVID, we realised the need to up our online game, which we did a couple of years ago, and we thanked our lucky stars for that with lockdown." She began running Cosita's creative workshop 6 months after she opened, and Emma says she didn't expect it to be as popular as it has been. "I was keen to add another element to the business that engages the community, and this seemed perfect." She can now call on the talents of 15 expert workshop leaders teaching over 25 workshops. Last year, Cosita's was voted one of the UK's top 15 most innovative retailers by BIRA, British Independent Retailers Association, as a result of the workshops and a virtual shopping experience shot by local award-winning Google photographer Striking Places. Emma added, "Over the years, I've learned that a successful high street is so dependent upon the community it serves, And here in St Albans, we're really lucky to be surrounded by a forward-thinking and supportive bunch. Community initiatives like Snowflakes at Christmas, where customers can adorn the shop ceilings with snowflakes with names of people they're thinking of at Christmas for a small charity donation, are an example of how she keeps the experience personal and relevant. Emma added, "During lockdown, we filled our windows with rainbow hearts to show our gratitude for members of our community who've been amazing during the pandemic." As a single mum, the impact on her family life has been quite considerable, with Emma frequently working a 15-hour day. "It's just me, at home with my three children, which means my income is my sole income. That can be tricky, but the children are so understanding. When I opened Kazita's gifts this week, I said to them, 'I'm sorry, guys, I promise we'll go on holiday next year.' And they just laughed and said, 'You've been saying that for 3 years, Mum.' The fact that they weren't bothered was lovely of them, but it also made me really sad that it's what they've come to expect. I'm actually really relieved that COVID took the pressure off this year. The older children have really had to step up in the home because being at work so much leaves very little time for hoovering and changing beds. I think they understand that I don't want to build something good that keeps me working like this, but something great that will eventually allow me the freedom to have the adventure I dream of having with them. Our first stop will be a family moon, Greek island hopping." I spoke to a friend who has a similar business in a town nearby and told her how guilty I feel that I keep ploughing into this and as a result I'm taking away from the children, and she said, "If you taught them never to go for things, never to work hard, never to strive for the best version of yourself through graft and sheer determination, then you'd be messing up their lives. You are entrepreneurial and they must be incredibly proud of your grit and tenacity, and as a result will learn from you." That made me feel so much better. And in lockdown, I helped my 19-year-old set up her own little business, which makes me so proud. So maybe I have given them more than I realise with this business. And there's some photos of Emma in her new Kazita's gift shop in front of some delicious-looking candles that look as though they must have fantastic smells to them. And she's surrounded by more gifts, T-shirts and cactuses. Looks like a fantastic shop.
Lorry landfill scheme replaced with eco-friendly pitch initiative. A staggering 1,400 lorry journeys back and forth to a landfill site will be avoided by work to contour a football pitch and events area in Harpenden Park. Around 10,000 cubic metres of subsoil was excavated during the construction of the new 20 million Rothamsted Leisure Centre development. But rather than stick to the original plan of using a fleet of trucks to transport the material to the landfill, a more eco-friendly initiative was devised. The pitch has now been fenced off and work is underway to transfer the soil and start the levelling works before the land is seeded. The project is likely to take up to 9 weeks and the land will remain fenced off until the grass is established. Contractor Wilmot Dixon is carrying out the work on behalf of park owners, St Albans District Council. Planning permission for the spoil project was obtained this year, while environmental tests confirmed it was free of asbestos or other contaminants and suitable for reuse. Councillor Robert Donald, portfolio holder for Commercial Development and Wellbeing, said, "The spoil has been safely stored on site while preparation work for the contouring was undertaken. This is an initiative with a double purpose in terms of environmental sustainability and improvements to the outdoor leisure activities in the park. We are reusing a huge amount of material that would otherwise be wasted in landfill, and we will be carrying out much needed levelling work on a football pitch where other events are sometimes held. There will also be a significant reduction in construction traffic that will result from relocating this spoil within the park itself, and is a further demonstration of our commitment to improve the environment." The swimming pool building in the park is being transformed into a state-of-the-art leisure centre. It will include an improved gym, new cafe, sports hall, sauna, steam room, learner pool, and a refurbished main pool. The nearby sports centre is being converted into a multi-purpose cultural centre, fit for the 21st century, replacing ageing Harpenden Public Halls in South Down Road. It will also include a 511-seat theatre, two function rooms, an exhibition space, bars on two floors, and a cafe overlooking the park. The leisure centre is due to open this winter, and the cultural centre is set to open in mid-2021.
Here are some suggestions for radio programmes you might like to listen to in the coming week, starting with Saturday, September 19th. At 5:30pm on Radio 4 Extra, you can hear a repeated episode of Great Lives, which celebrates the legacy of actress, singer and politician Melina Mercouri. Over on Radio 4 at 7:15, in Miles Jupp is Literally Unputdownable, he investigates fiction that completely engrosses the reader and talks, among others, to author Frederick Forsyth and critic DJ Taylor. Then at 8pm on Radio 4, in Archive on 4, a broadcasting life, Sue McGregor looks back on 5 decades of broadcasting in this final goodbye to Radio 4, marking the end of 52 years of continuous broadcasting on the BBC. She'll be missed. At 9:45 on Radio 4, in the last part of Anglesey, Anna Maria Marinka reads Fox Season, the last of 3 specially commissioned tales exploring different perspectives of life in London's Polish community. Despite her husband's objections, Amelia is determined to keep feeding the foxes at night. On to Sunday, September 20th. At 11:45am on Radio 4, as part of the series The Rise and Fall of the Antique, post-war Portobello examines the interest in antiques in the 1960s. Over on Radio 4 Extra at 1pm in a programme from 2011, Take It From June is an interview with June Whitfield about her 60 years in radio, with excerpts from many of her shows. Getting Together, in this week's episode of Words and Music, in which poets and novelists reflect on time spent in groups, whether with loved ones and friends or as audiences, at ceremonies and casual meetups or in crowds. It includes music by Haydn, Verdi and Leonard Cohen, and readings from the work of Virginia Woolf, Thomas Hardy, E.M. Forster, William Blake and others. It's at 5:30pm on Radio 3. Sunday night is Music Night on Radio 2 at 7pm, when Larry Blank conducts the BBC Concert Orchestra in a tribute to Hollywood song and dance star Gene Kelly. The drama on Radio 3 at 7:30 is Beethoven Can Hear You, starring Peter Capaldi as the composer in a new drama. Beethoven is visited by a deaf traveller from another time who is shocked to discover that he can hear. Beethoven is haunted by the fear that his ears could fail him, but the visitor must make him understand his importance as history's first deaf composer. On Radio 4 Extra at 9pm, Desert Island Discs Revisited is a 1996 edition with former international cricket umpire Harold Dennis Dickey Bird discussing his life. On to those programmes now, which are broadcast at the same time every day on the same channel from Monday to Friday. So at the same time, same channel, every day, Monday to Friday, throughout the working week. At 9:45am on Radio 4 FM and repeated at 12:30 each day, the book of the week is Dear Life. Dr. Rachel Clark strives to forge human connections at times of crisis. Her tender and uplifting memoir reveals how love and kindness can be found in the darkest of places. The 15-minute drama at 10:45am on Radio 4 and repeated at 7:45pm is Things Fall Apart, about the rise and fall of Okonkwo, a powerful Igbo clan leader. A neighbouring clan commits an offence against Umuafia, so to avoid war, they present him with a young boy who is entrusted to Okonkwo. On Radio 3 at 12 noon, the composer of the week is again Beethoven, this week focusing on the spirit of the age, a week of programmes exploring the wider world around Beethoven. Just after midday on Radio 4 and then repeated at 10:45pm each night, Monday to Friday, in The Vanishing Futurist, 22-year-old Gertie Freely travels to Russia to work as a governess, little knowing the upheavals that lie ahead. Over on Radio 4 Extra, there's a dramatisation of Firefly Summer by Maeve Binchy. Mount Fern is a quiet Irish village until the arrival of an ambitious American, Patrick O'Neill. You can hear it at 6am for early birds, 1pm at lunchtime, and 8pm in the evening. Finally, at 10:45 on Radio 3 for our final one of the same time, same channel, every day, Monday to Friday, is the essay, Five Kinds of Beethoven, considers the composer today in a contemporary and personal context. It's on Radio 3 at 10:45 p.m. all week. On to those individual programmes then to listen to through the week, starting with Monday, September 21st. The second part of Vaccines, Money and Politics can be heard on Radio 4 at 11 a.m, analysing the complex decisions about who should get a COVID-19 vaccine once it's developed and how to persuade people to take it. Still on Radio 4 at 2:45, in a new series, The Escaped Lyric explores the world of the song lyric and the way it can help articulate and negotiate different aspects of life. This first episode focuses on solitude. Followed at 3 p.m. on Radio 4 by the first semi-final of Brain of Britain. Tuesday, September 22nd, and looks like on Radio 4 at 11 a.m, the last in the series, Science Stories, is Blood Banks. In 1940, Britain struggled to treat thousands of civilians injured in the Blitz and many more soldiers at Dunkirk. Then Charles Drew, an African-American doctor, came to the rescue. Dr. Drew was the driving force behind a project called Plasma for Britain, which saved many lives. But when a similar project was rolled out in the US, the authorities insisted that the blood be segregated. Charles Drew resigned and returned to work at a black establishment. In the first part of No Triumph, No Tragedy, at 4 p.m. on Radio 4, Peter White meets Haben Girmer, the first deaf-blind graduate from Harvard Law School, who is now breaking barriers to tackle discrimination on a worldwide scale. Radio 3, in concert at 7:30 p.m, has much-loved classics of the opera repertory performed at the Royal Opera House, with the Opera House Chorus and Orchestra performing together in person for the first time since March 15th. Finally, for this day, Tuesday, September 22nd, at 11 p.m. on Radio 4, is the first part of To Hull and Back, a four-part comedy drama starring Maureen Lipman. Sophie pins her hopes on escaping the family home on an acting audition and reluctantly enlists the help of her mother, but the overprotective parent takes her role a little bit too seriously. Moving on to Wednesday, September 23rd, Radio 4, 9:30 a.m, and this week's edition of Forethought is called Craftivism, Gentle Protest, and looks at a combination of craft and activism, which together create gentle protest. Activists carefully craft objects which communicate respectful messages for social change. At 2 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra, Sue Perkins hosts the first in a new series of the panel show Dilemma, in which guests discuss moral dilemmas. Choral Evensong is at 3:30 on Radio 3. It comes from Portsmouth Cathedral. At 8 p.m. on Radio 4 in The Spark, Helen Lewis is joined by the educationalist Kieran Gill to hear how she is setting out to improve the life chances of children excluded from mainstream education. Thursday, September 24th, starts at 9 a.m. on Radio 4 in Our Time. Melvin Bragg hosts a discussion about cave art, looking at who created it in the Stone Age, what it might have been like to experience it, why some was public and some private, whether any of the art was created by Neanderthals, and if it was, how the challenges of old ideas of what it means to be human. In Packing Up the Family Home at 11:30 on Radio 4, Jeff Bird and his siblings set about sorting through half a century's worth of stuff in their parents' house, throwing up treasures, surprises and long-forgotten memories. In Claire Balding's Ramblings at 3 p.m. on Radio 4, Barry Faramond, who plays Ed Grundy in The Archers, takes Claire for an adventurous hike across Dartmoor. And in Front Row, at 7:15 on Radio 4, Samira Ahmed interviews the winner of the Book Trust Lifetime Achievement Award for 2020, which is given to a children's writer or illustrator. And so the end of another week, Friday, September 25th, 11:30 on Radio 4, Believe It is the first part of a fictional comedy biography of Richard Wilson, narrated by the actor and featuring dramatised scenes from his untrue life story. Maybe I should have said, believe it. In Short Works at 3:45 on Radio 4, Maggie Cronin reads Post by Elaine Feeney, the story of an unlikely friendship between two neighbours in rural Ireland. Front Row on Radio 4 at 7pm has a programme from Dove Cottage in the Lake District, once the home of William Wordsworth, as part of the BBC's annual poetry festival marking 250 years since Wordsworth's birth. In Radio 3, in concert at 7:30, Simon Rattle conducts the London Symphony Orchestra in a concert recorded earlier this week at the London Symphony Orchestra St Luke's. It features Dvorak's Slavonic Dances, Tippett's Piano Concerto, and Beethoven's Symphony No. 5 in C minor. As ever, we hope you enjoy your week of listening, and may I also wish you a peaceful and safe one too.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly nature notes for the Hearts ad. When does autumn begin? I know I am not alone in wondering exactly when autumn begins. Many times on social media this summer, I have come across people asking the very same question. I can imagine it has followed on from a moment of resigned dismay, perhaps synonymous with living in Britain, at wind, rain and chill when it was meant to be summer. Of course, the answer to the question is no great mystery, albeit taking the form of two options, a meteorological one or an astronomical one. Generally, it is the astronomical date that is taken as the start of autumn, a date around the 22nd of September, when day and night are roughly equal, the autumn equinox. For practical reasons, the 1st of September is sometimes taken as the start of autumn, for instance, by meteorologists, so that the seasons fit neatly into three-month periods. But this is not really what is at the heart of the question at hand. Instead, it is a far more subjective matter about when autumn starts for you. The answer you give will be far more to do with your own feelings and observations, even memories and traditions, than the science of the Earth's orbit around the sun. Maybe your autumn doesn't start until late in October, when leaves pile up and the air turns chill. For you, the autumn is the fall, with all its colours and glowing glory of fading foliage. Or maybe it is the first damp day, when moisture lingers beyond dawn and the sun seems to struggle to dry everything out, even though it's August. Was it maybe when the swifts left? I remember the day, back in late July, when suddenly the skies over my garden cleared of swifts. Their constant screaming acrobatics had gone, and instead, a few days later, I espied a flock of several hundred moving as one high across the skies. A new purpose had possessed them, and like little iron filings, they had aligned with some unseen magnetic field. There is a twinge of sadness in these moments, a sense of loss, and that is maybe part of what autumn means to us. By the end of the first 2 weeks of July, the songbirds have virtually fallen silent. The blackbird's soft meditation subsumed in the heat of summer, and not to be heard again until next spring. Conkers appear and toadstools push up in damp corners. The natural scene begins to shift once more. The more time you spend out in nature, the more evident the shifting seasons will be, and perhaps that is why I have heard this question of autumn's entrance being asked more this year than ever before. The truth about autumn is one that we'd perhaps prefer not to hear, for in the natural world, autumn follows spring, not summer. Summer is our own construct, our hoped-for season of holiday rest, of lazy days and carefree moments. But in the natural world, autumn has begun, and perhaps we sense it instinctively too on those occasions when we wonder, has autumn arrived today? Though this may come with a sense of sadness as we feel our summer slipping away, there is no such melancholy in nature. Instead, change is apace, bringing new variety and interest if you know where to look. I asked myself the same question recently, and I know the answer. For me, autumn began this year on the 12th of June, yes, that early, with the arrival of two small birds at the local gravel pits. Feeding quietly at the back of a shallow lagoon, two green sandpipers heralded the start of the great move south for winter, involving millions of birds across Britain, Europe and beyond. These little waders most likely bred in Finland and Russia, and their arrival alerted me to the changing season, sharpening my senses to the likelihood of further new arrivals, and drawing my attention to the myriad of subtle shifts. These little signs are there to be discovered, and come September are declared in aggregate and officially to constitute a new season, autumn.
A century ago this month, Geoffrey de Havilland founded the Herz Aircraft Company that would play a major role in aviation history. His legacy is marked by a new £2 million exhibition space. This article is from Hertfordshire Life. It's called Blue Sky Thinking. I'm Sue, and the words are by Richard Burton. Lancashire has its cotton mills, Staffordshire its breweries, Cornwall its tin mines, and here in Hertfordshire, we have aerospace. I was reminded of that as I entered the newly upgraded de Havilland Aircraft Museum. That, and the fact that a satellite launched in February from Cape Canaveral to orbit the sun, is just the latest space explorer built by Airbus in Stevenage. So it was ironic then that, like some rookie pilot who left his goggles behind, I completely overshot the country lane of landing strip that takes you to the B-556 near London Coney, to the exquisite Tudor Manor that is Salisbury Hall, and home to the de Havilland collection. You're not the first to do that, curator Alastair Hodgson told me. We're a bit of a well-kept secret along this road. It's part of the attraction. The former engineer, who had himself stumbled upon the place in days when, like lots of youngsters, he was captivated by Airfix models, agreed to show me around its latest asset, a giant hangar that was, until a few fateful months ago, set to be the centrepiece of celebrations to mark 100 years of this most iconic of aircraft companies. The Sir Geoffrey de Havilland hangar, funded by a national lottery grant approaching £2 million, has added a new dimension to this volunteer-run museum, which opened in 1959, making it the oldest aviation museum in Britain. The hangar is bolted to one named after Walter Goldsmith, former owner and restorer of Salisbury Hall, which was opened by the Queen Mother in 1982. For anyone with a germ of interest in aviation, this was money well spent. It not only includes a 100-seat mezzanine for functions, it is a space where enthusiasts can get up close to planes and watch and chat to restorers at work. It's a place where the Comet, the world's first jetliner, lies stretched out into the distance, and Second World War guided missiles line up along the walls. It's also where the first drone, the DH-82B, Queen Bee, controlled not from a handheld device, but from a telephone dial mounted on a metal box the size of a litter bin, sits yards away from the C-24 autogyro, the cartoon-like half-plane, half-helicopter, once built in secret near Hatfield. And it's one where any of the 100 or so volunteers will instinctively chip in with anecdotes and the sort of technical, detailed, too wordy to fit in on any of the displays or video screens that guide visitors on their socially distanced one-way tour. It's grown out of all recognition in the past 10 years, says Alistair. But then again, things had to change quickly. When you're a small museum in a growing world, eventually you're going to run out of runway. I asked him what makes the museum special. There are lots of museums that display planes, but we try to be a more coherent collection. There are very few of those in the UK. When I visit a museum, I like to leave feeling that someone has told me a story, and that's exactly what we try to do here. I can't improve on what former BBC Director General Lord Reith said when he spoke of needing to inform, educate, and entertain. We need to do just that. Thanks to a well-executed marketing campaign, the museum grew the sort of inclusive audience essential to sustain a visitor attraction. We used to get ex-pilots or good old boys from Hawker Siddeley, but if you want to survive, you have to get mum, dad and two kids, Alistair explains. That's not to dismiss the retired airmen, many of whom bring with them their own stories, such as the elderly chap who took one look at the nose of a Trident and announced, "I think I've flown that," and so he had. His wife confirmed it, she was the stewardess, and they met on board. In fact, as recently as a few weeks ago, the museum was able to reunite, albeit online, two members of the last crew of a Sea Venom. The pilot was from Buxton in Derbyshire. The navigator was local. They hadn't seen each other for 60 years. That webinar was part of the effort to keep the place alive during lockdown. That, and 50 short instructional films, shot on events manager Stephanie Marshall's mobile phone. All a far cry from the 10-strong tour groups Alistair once led around the hangars. The Cub Scouts researching for their badges, teenagers doing GCSEs, or the families who would fill the small field of a car park, big enough to take 60 at a time. Having to lock down was heartbreaking after all the work we'd done, Alistair says. Business was booming, then we lost it all in a couple of weeks. We were open for just 28 days before we had to lock up. It's unlikely we'll see us fully function again until November. It's unlikely we'll see us fully functioning again until November. Today, people are back, but numbers are smaller. And that's a blessing because not all the stewards, many typically of retirement age, were happy to return so soon. Even so, the ones that were are here, clad in PPE visors and certainly not reluctant to engage. One who saw me admiring the autogyro stepped forward with a black and white video on his phone when he overheard me question its airworthiness. Another told me of his J.R. Hartley moment, of finding the book Flying Minnows by a First World War fighter pilot, writing as Roger V, in the second-hand book rack after searching fruitlessly for it for years. But it's a museum, after all, one where stories come as thick and fast as a volley from a front-mounted Lewis automatic. They are what makes us what we are, says the marketing manager, Mike Nevin. While the museum is about products we display, it's also about the stories they prompt from the people who come to see them. Preserving the heritage is important, as de Havilland was one of the biggest innovators of the 20th century in terms of aviation. And what we have here are not just one or two aircraft, but an entire lineage. And then there's the location. Salisbury House has enough stories of its own to tell. Aside from its well-documented wartime legacy, aviation first came to Salisbury Hall in October 1939, when the de Havilland Mosquito design team moved from the company HQ in Hatfield as a security precaution against the government stopping work on the project. This once moated manor house, knocked down and rebuilt several times, was home to Nell Gwynne in the 17th century, and Lady Randolph Churchill at the start of the 20th, even providing the isolation a young Winston Churchill needed to write his speeches. The museum tells it all from the beginning, preceding the de Havilland Aircrafts Company formation 100 years ago this month. One of the first images to greet visitors is of the de Havilland's wife, Louise, stitching together the fabric for one of the first aircraft wings on a classic Singer sewing machine. Behind her is the propeller of a BE-2, which de Havilland designed and flew himself to a height of 10,560 feet, a record at the time, on August 12, 1912. That was 3 years after his first attempt, one that, thanks to the unstable design and pilot inexperience, he and fellow designer Frank Hurl had never seen an aircraft before, saw it crash, only to be salvaged and taken to a workshop in Fulham. Here, a more successful aircraft was built and eventually sold to the RAF factory in Farnborough for £400. The sale secured jobs there for de Havilland and his friend and fellow pioneer Hale. It was there that de Havilland was able to design and test fly many of his own aircraft, including that BE-2. When the First World War broke out, the pair joined the aircraft manufacturing company, Airco, at Hendon, producing fighters, trainers, and the DH-10 twin-engine bomber, all designed by de Havilland. When the First World War ended, it was the aviation business that crashed, and Airco was sold initially to BSA, with de Havilland forming his eponymous company at Stag Lane Aerodrome in Edgware on September 15, 1920, taking around 60 Airco staff with him. Testing and then production was moved to a new aerodrome on the former farmland in Hatfield in the 1930s. During this decade, the company produced a highly successful series of light touring and training aircraft, including the DH-2 Tiger Moth, which became the standard RAF elementary trainer during the Second World War. The rest, as they say, is history. The company would continue at Hatfield Aerodrome, creating innovation after innovation with the Mosquito, Dove, Vampire, Chipmunk, Venom, Sea Vixen, Comet, and many others. And that history is all there down a lane you may well overshoot if you don't use those goggles and trust your instruments. Well, sat-nav anyway.
This article from Heart's Life is called New World Pioneer. It's about the Hartford Puritan pioneer Samuel Stone, who founded what would become a state capital and a keystone in U.S. democracy. This month, 400 years after the Pilgrim Fathers sailed to the New World, we look at his remarkable life and legacy. Words are by Gillian Thornton. Hertfordshire isn't short on important figures from history. Just think of Alban, first Christian martyr, or Nicholas Breakspear, England's only pope. Queen Elizabeth I spent her childhood at Hatfield House, and George Bernard Shaw wrote his influential plays at Ayot St. Lawrence. But however well you know your county, few residents are familiar with Samuel Stone. Born in Hertford on July the 18th, 1602, Samuel Stone put his birthplace on the New World map, bestowing it on a settlement founded between Boston and New York. Years later, Hartford, with an A, would become the capital city of Connecticut State. Nicknamed the insurance capital of the world, it would also number author Mark Twain among its residents. The story begins in our county town, where the Stone family lived on 4th Street in the early years of the 17th century. Walk across Mill Bridge today and you can't miss Samuel, a striking figure in a broad-brimmed hat and frock coat, head held high, prayer book in one hand and the other pointing heavenwards, forefinger outstretched. Created by sculptor Henry Tebbutt, this evocative statue was commissioned to mark the millennium by local businessman Keith Marshall, who retired in October 2018 from the family furniture store on 4th Street. John and Sarah Stone had their third son baptized at All Saints Church, and in 1617 Samuel became one of the first pupils at the nearby grammar school, founded that same year by wealthy London merchant Richard Hale. Originally known as Richard Hale's School, it later became Hartford Grammar School, before being renamed again as Richard Hale School. In 1620, Samuel Stone left school to study theology at Emmanuel College in Cambridge, and in 1626 he was ordained at Peterborough. A year later he became curate at Stysted in Essex, where he lived with wife Hope and daughter Sarah. But Samuel had his eye on distant horizons, inspired by the Pilgrim Fathers who had left Portsmouth in September 1620 and crossed the Atlantic on the Mayflower, to found the settlement of New Plymouth in America. A dedicated Puritan, Samuel believed that the Church of England should be simplified and stripped of its ornaments and music, all too Catholic for Puritan tastes. A promised land with Christianity refreshed awaited across the ocean. So in 1633, Samuel sailed the Atlantic on board Griffin with his friend Thomas Hooker, arriving in Boston in September. He initially settled in Newtown, where Hooker acted as pastor with Stone, his assistant teacher. In 1638, the growing city was renamed Cambridge in honour of the English university city, and today is home to Harvard University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Hooker and Stone had moved on before the rebranding. After reportedly disagreeing with some of the other settlers, they set out westwards in 1636. With around 100 colonists, intent on carving out their own future. Not that they were first on the scene. Dutch explorers had sailed up the Connecticut River some 20 years earlier, establishing Fort Hope, also known as the House of Hope, at the highest navigable point. Hooker and Stone carried on beyond the Dutch settlers, making peace with the local First Nations and putting down roots in a place the original inhabitants called Saukiog. In 1637, Hooker and Stone renamed it Hartford, in honour of Stone's birthplace. They also adopted the Hartford stag, or hart, on the emblem of their new town. It still takes centre stage on the Hartford flag and city seal, a permanent reminder of a place in England where hearts would cross the ford. Samuel's friend and colleague, Reverend Hooker, predeceased him in 1647. taken by one of the several epidemics that felled so many of the Puritan colonists. Samuel's first wife, Hope, had also died. He remarried in 1641 and had at least 4 more children. As for the city he founded, Hartford made a significant contribution to its local society that was to have an impact on a far wider scale. The Fundamental Orders adopted by the colony in 1639 was the first document to establish a government by the consent of the people. This was later reflected in the drawing up of the United States Constitution, earning Connecticut the moniker the Constitution State. With its strategic position on the Connecticut, Hartford grew into an important river port, with a thriving merchant district where warehouses were piled high with molasses and spices, coffee and rum. Ships set sail to England, the West Indies, and the Far East. Merchants, however, lived in constant fear of bad weather, pirates, and ship fires, so they decided to group together to share risks. The start of an insurance industry, which was formalized in 1810, with the creation of the Hartford Fire Insurance Group. More than 200 years later, the Hartford Insurance Company is America's oldest underwriters. Hartford also became famous as the home of Samuel Langhorne Clemens, better known as Mark Twain. Born in 1835, he lived in Hartford with his family from 1874 to 1891, writing many of his classic novels here, including The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. His impressive Gothic gabled property is now a museum. Samuel Stone is commemorated in the town he named, with the replica of the statue that stands in our Hartford by Mill Bridge. In January 2003, the Hartford Courant of Hartford, Connecticut, the oldest continuously published newspaper in the world, reported on a welcome reception held before the statue was installed in its permanent home in front of the ancient burying ground, Stone's last resting place. The paper reported, "The reception caps a project that began when Hartford, Connecticut residents Karen and Phil Will visited Hartford, England, in 1999 and found considerable interest both in Stone and in forming a relationship with its namesake city in the United States. A committee was set up to liaise between the capital city of Connecticut State and the county town of Hertfordshire, and more than $30,000 was raised by state sponsors for the Samuel Stone statue. And while the two towns are not officially twinned, a number of connections were made and personal friendships forged. Samuel Stone breathed his last in Hartford, Connecticut on July the 20th, 1663, aged 61, a world away from his birthplace. Contemporary accounts describe him as an outspoken and highly principled man, though he left little written work behind him. His A Short Catechism Drawn Out of the Word of God was published 21 years after his death. He is commemorated in Hartford with a moving epitaph that gives the measure of this principled pioneer. It goes like this: "New England's glory and her radiant crown was he who now in softest bed of down, till glorious resurrection morn appear, doth safely, sweetly sleep in Jesus here. In nature's solid art and reasoning well, 'tis known beyond compare he did excel. Errors corrupt by sinuous dispute, he did oppugn and clearly them confute. Above all things he Christ above preferred, Hartford, thy richest jewels here interred."
Now, would you like traffic to travel more slowly on your road? Apparently 70% of us would, so it's no surprise that there's a new campaign group active in St Albans, 20's Plentiful St Albans District. I started by talking to Rod King MBE, founder of the national campaign group 20's Plenty. So, Rod King, thank you very much indeed for joining me. So, is 20 miles per hour as a speed limit, is it really much different from 30 miles per hour?
One of the things which you can do is think of it in metres per second, because 20 miles an hour is 9 metres every second, whereas 30 miles an hour adds another 4.5 metres to that every second. And if you look out in the road and actually see what 5 meters is, then you'll see that a car moving at an extra 5 meters a second is going to make quite a difference. And a very important aspect is in the distance a 20-mile-an-hour can stop, a 30-mile-an-hour car is still doing 24 miles an hour. The difference is quite a bit in terms of both avoiding collisions and reducing the consequence of collisions when they do happen.
Is there any evidence, given that there are obviously safety differences between 20 mile an hour and 30 mile an hour, is there any evidence that more people feel safer and choose to cycle or walk?
There is. I know in one of the big exercises which we've done in the south side of Edinburgh, I think they found there was a tripling of children walking and cycling to school, which came from 20 mile an hour limits. I think one of the things is which we do find, though, that those local authorities who predisposed to say, let's make it better for walkers and cyclists by setting a 20 mile an hour limit, are also doing the other things which are making a difference, like producing perhaps cycling maps, providing cycle training, and so on. So it's that whole approach. We think 20 mile an hour as an initiative in an authority as a default is very much a litmus test of their attitude towards active travel.
Is it just cyclists who benefit from a lower speed limit, or does it benefit people more generally?
Oh, it's not just about cyclists. When we're walking, children, for example, there's been research done which says not until they get beyond primary school age can children be relied upon to accurately assess the speed of vehicles which are travelling above 20 miles an hour. So children get a benefit, walkers get a big benefit just in the pace which there is on the road, and the noise reduces by about half when you get a 20 mile an hour limit. The disabled have benefits. And of course, we must remember that disability doesn't only, if you like, take the form of visible features such as being in a wheelchair, people who have hearing difficulties or have sight difficulties, and people who are just slow, maybe the elderly. All of these people benefit from a 20 mile an hour limit. Indeed, we quite often say that for the elderly, the pace of traffic on their roads is so important, because when an elderly person decides that the speed of the traffic is such that they don't want to travel to the shops every other day or every week walking down to the shops, then of course they become much less mobile and less active. So yes, slower vehicles on our roads makes a huge difference for everybody else who's using those roads.
So, you know, you've sort of shown the benefits there, but isn't there a problem with enforcing 20 mile an hour limits? You know, one of the things that we often see is speed bumps, and they are not very popular. Are they a necessary part of lower speed limits?
Let's start off with this issue of enforcement and saying there's a problem with enforcement. Well, they don't seem to have a problem with it in Avon and Somerset, where, in fact, in 2018, the police issued over 25,000 notices of intended prosecution on roads which had 20 mile an hour limits. So really, the idea of enforcement being difficult is really just in the hands of the police forces. Avon and Somerset don't find it difficult. Metropolitan Police don't find it difficult. West Midlands Police don't find it difficult. So it's really there to be done. And of course, when the police do enforce it, even if they enforce it a little bit, they're actually sending a key message out to motorists and the community that we are protecting the community by enforcing 20 mile an hour limits wherever they are.
We're nearing the end of this week's programme. It just remains for me to thank our contributors, Jenny, Dominic, Anna, Caroline and Sue, and of course John for the radio listings, and Rupert for his nature notes. Steve will be here next week with News Extra, but that's all from me in September 2020. We close with Tatsu by Shilanigig. I hope you enjoy it. Goodbye for now, and stay safe.